Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Chapter 5, A Curse Upon the Digressive Principle.
McQueen, Bibliographer. You may recall that I had quite made up my mind to leave Timor Mortis College and spend a few days at my club in London. I had told myself I would leave the ear trumpet of death behind in my rooms, but when the moment came, I could not do it. In truth, I was loath to let it out of my sight, and wrapped the precious object in my bibliographer's smock and slipped it into my bag before departing my rooms. I had, of course, left strict instructions with Carolus Parvus, the deputy under-tyrant of the college, to feed my beloved cat Dogrel in my absence, and so, full of claret, Gruber's tomato ketchup, kangaroo, wildebeest giraffe and gorilla, Thursday was big game night in the dining hall, I set out for the smogs and fogs of the metropolis, and the Duodecimo Club. However, as I hurried across the quadrangle, past the statues of Alan Titchmarsh and Barnaby the Bear, a tall, dark figure arose before me. My first thought was that this was Death, come to reclaim his ear trumpet, and then I remembered that a mincing friar had been spotted around the college in recent weeks, and assumed that this would be he, and braced myself for an attempted conversion to Cripsianity. But no, this man was neither Death, nor an envoy of the Church of the Minced Oath, but our own detested principal, Dr. Martius Boyle, known universally as Marshy Arseboyle, wearing his academic gown and sable crown.
Ho, McQueen, where are you off to in such a hurry?
I have a train to catch, principal.
Nonsense, you must stop a while and talk with me.
As I mentioned, he is a complete arseboyle, but we are all obliged to bow and grovel before him, as he has the power of life and death in college. Only last month he had one of the dons expelled for splitting an infinitive, and another beaten up by hired goons for making rabbit ears behind the principal's head when he thought himself unobserved. Certainly, principal, what can I do for you?
Well, McQueen, it's about this cheese.
Cheese, principal?
Yes, McQueen, you know full well that someone in the college has been stealing from the cheese cellar. I want you to do something about it.
A humble professor emeritus of bibliography has no power over cheese, sir.
Poppycock! As of this moment, you are cheese monitor. I want you to go down to the cellar and begin your investigation at once.
Curse the man. I saw my longed-for sojourn at my club disappearing behind a mound of Stilton. I had to act quickly to divert the wretch's course. I am sorry, Principal. I have a terrible confession to make. I am fromageophobic. It is a recognized medical condition. I cannot go anywhere near large quantities of cheese, especially French cheese, without suffering an extreme reaction. If you look it up in the Health and Safety Proclamation, you will find fromageophobia listed under Section 16, Paragraph 4, Subsection 2C. It would be an infringement of the proclamation to allow, let alone oblige, a fromageophobic to enter a cheese cellar.
But this is nonsense, McQueen. I've seen you eating camembert at high table.
Ah, yes, in small quantities, sir. It is part of the treatment prescribed for me by Dr. Theodora Cox, the college's foxy toxicologist.
Buggeration! What can I do about this wretched cheese thief?
I will tell you the name of the man to solve the case. Dank Washbasin, the professor of political science. He's Swedish and knows all there is to know about cheese. I suggest you put him on the case and ask him to write a paper on the subject for the next meeting of ruling council.
Excellent idea. I am an ideas man, as you know. Ideas are what I bring to Timor Mortis. Now, McQueen, what are you going to do about the snails?
I heaved a heavy sigh, inwardly. Outwardly, I smiled. Snails, Principal?
Don't play innocent with me, McQueen. You know full well that the Principal's garden is being devoured by a plague of snails. I've had the gardener killing them, one by one, with a brick, but there seem to be more than ever.
I am afraid my fromageophobia extends to all French foodstuffs, including snails.
My God, they're French snails? This is worse than I thought. But I have an idea. I will tell that tosser Maturin, the French professor of German and Spanish, to write a paper for ruling council on how to exterminate the shell-bound little bastards. They're his snails, after all.
What an excellent idea, Principal. You are, as you say, an ideas man. Now I really must away and catch my train. I'm on urgent college business.
Well, go, 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 then. Don't fart around here detaining me. Attend to your urgent college business.
At once, Principal. I'm even now on urgent college business. My ass. I added the last two words under my breath as I hurried away from the detestable fellow. I had missed my train and had to wait at Knoxford Station for 40 minutes for the next one, but I had a flask of brandy and my notes on the mystery of the Codex Asinorum, so that my wait would not be an entirely fruitless one. I settled in the waiting room and began to tope and to study bibliography. The time passed with extraordinary celerity, and it seemed to me only a few seconds before my train was announced.
All
aboard! Bicycles in the tender, on top of the coal, please! All aboard for London! All aboard for London Town!
Once aboard the train, I was lucky to find myself alone in a compartment. I spread myself and lit my pipe, then took out the ear trumpet. I did not feel I could use it in company, but here, alone in a railway compartment, I fitted it to my ear. I confess to being a little befuddled at this point, and my mind had certainly been wandering away from the world of the Codex. It wandered to the year 1971, and I found myself listening to an independent television programme, the famous science fiction series initiated as an English rival to the American programmes which had been so popular in the 1960s. As a student, I had loved The Venus Probe, and the trumpet had somehow drawn it out of my mind while I had been concentrating upon rather more ancient matters. This is the log of the starship Venus. Captain Jonathan T. Hansen in command. The year is 2020, and on a mission to probe the second planet of our solar system, the most well-equipped and advanced starship of His Majesty's Royal Astro Navy was blown clear across the galaxy by a quantum explosion on the planet's red-hot surface. Travelling at 100 times the speed of light, we managed at last to apply the handbrake and found ourselves in deep space. With no maps to guide us and no way to return home, or even an inkling of where home now was, we had no choice but to drive on, past psychedelically coloured planets and strange glowing nebulae, armed only with the finest crew in the Astro Navy, and a battery of powerful and terrifying futuristic weapons. This is the Venus Probe.
Well, my Venus Probe, hear me, Venus Probe. This is my Venus Probe into space. Well, my Venus Probe, you should have seen us grow. My Venus Probe, and it's nice.
He left his crew, used not to few rude words that had to ban some.
We're on the Venus Globe, we're on the Venus Globe. This is the Venus Globe, into space. We're on the Venus Globe, you should have seen us grow. We're on the Venus Globe, and it's endless.
Thank you.
Commander Flaff?
Captain, you wanted to speak to me?
Yes, indeed. I have Dogrel here in his basket, too.
Mew?
And our twin computers, Reggie and Ronnie, are standing by.
I see. The five finest minds aboard the Venus are gathered here in the briefing room. You, the captain of the ship, with your 12 years' experience of starship business. Dogrel the cat, who has the brain of our erstwhile superior, Rear Admiral Devenish, transferred into his skull during the battle in Episode 2 when we fought the brain jugglers of Havador.
Mew!
Reggie and Ronnie, the very zenith of terrestrial computer design in the 21st century, and myself, Science Officer Flaff, a Claudian from the planet Garamond 12, with which the Earth commenced a student exchange scheme in the year 2017, and now a loyal member of the Royal Astronavy. Also, incidentally, a Claudian whose name consists of three typographical ligatures. My brother, Flaff, has four ligatures in his name. Strictly speaking, of course, Dogrel outranks you, Captain, and should be in command of this vessel. Perhaps, indeed, we should no longer call him Dogrel, but address him as Rear Admiral Devenish.
No, Flaff, he is a cat. Even if he has Devenish's brain, he is still more cat than man, and could hardly command a starship as I do. We must treat him with the respect due to a Rear Admiral, tickle the base of his tail when he demands it, give him the best dodo chunks, worm him regularly, etc. But he struggles to speak and is best suited to advise us from within his furry fastness.
Mew!
And what of the Rear Admiral's body, which now contains the brain of Dogrel the cat?
Out of respect for his rank, we should continue to address him as Rear Admiral Devenish. But we cannot allow him to attend officer briefings. He cannot be persuaded to wear his uniform or any clothes, and will insist on jumping up onto the table and either trying to climb into the lap of one of the officers or lying down and licking his own posterior. That is not the sort of thing we should allow a naked Rear Admiral to be seen doing.
So, Captain, why have you gathered our great brains together?
Opinions, gentlemen. I am concerned about Chief Engineer Green. He has been behaving uncharacteristically.
How so? I've noticed nothing.
Green is, as you know, a brilliant electrical and mechanical engineer. Before he joined the Astronavy, he worked for the post office, where he invented a franking machine.
A franking machine?
Yes, the finest franking machine the world has ever seen. But there was a terrible accident during its development, which put an end to his career with the Royal Mail and his chances of fatherhood. He was profoundly affected by this incident and switched allegiance, leaving postal engineering behind and signing up to be one of the world's first space engineers. I think he was running away, or, given the nature of his injuries, more likely sidling cautiously away. He is, as I say, a brilliant engineer, but mercurial, unpredictable, short-tempered, an immoderate tippler, and inclined to make hasty decisions and even the occasional blunder. But recently he has been quite different. He has been sober. His decisions have been measured and wise, his character stable, and his reports have been perfect in every detail. What has happened to Green? Gentlemen, computers?
Insufficient data. Which is an imbecile.
Well, Ronnie, what is your opinion?
Reggie is an imbecile.
I mean about the question of what has happened to Chief Engineer Green.
Insufficient data.
Dogrel?
Mew, he's been replaced with a robot.
Now, that seems rather unlikely, Pussy, especially as he has just been given a full medical examination by ship's surgeon Hopper and found to be in tip-top medical condition.
Can we trust Hopper? You know, Captain, what the crew say about him.
We all call him Chopper due to his supposed love of the scalpel.
They say that Chopper's scalpel is a whopper, and that he once chased a lady crewman with it, twice round the deck, grabbed her by the neck, and when she started to yell, performed a tracheotomy to stop her.
I can guarantee, Flaff, that that story is a lie. It is no more true than that the third planet in the Rubik system is a perfect cube, or that one glance from a clanger can turn a man to green soup or blue string pudding. These are mere space myths.
Yes, Captain, we all know about the clangers, having fallen foul of them in Episode 5. They were formidable adversaries and killed several of our expendables with their swanny pistols before we could destroy them, though they had no power to convert humans to curiously coloured foodstuffs with a single glance. I'm talking of the original race of Clangers, of course. When we met the new race in Episode 6, they were rubbish. But I wonder, Captain, if we should really be concerned about Green. If he is now more rational, logical, and efficient than heretofore, perhaps we should quietly rejoice and accept his newfound maturity.
That would be the obvious thing to do. That is what the book would demand. But every instinct tells me that something is badly wrong and that we are in danger.
Human instincts are something I can smell but cannot understand. However, I accept their utility even if they are illogical. I suggest we call Green in for a debriefing and try to determine what has occurred.
Very well. Lieutenant Morgan, please bring Chief Engineer Green to briefing room 3.
Aye, aye, sir.
I'm used now to the way humans look. So odd, but I still find Lieutenant Morgan a particularly hideous specimen of humanity.
You'll find Morgan hideous, Flaflaff. He is known as Morgan the Gorgon, but he is accomplished at playing the organ, which is very useful for weddings and funerals. I try to look beyond his pulsating and deformed features, and the fact that he is half Welsh and half Pakistani. In any case, Flaflaff, you must be aware that you look a little unearthly to us, with your nose on, upside down, like that.
It is not my nose which is upside down, sir, but yours, and it is my right-way-up nose which gives me my most refined and useful sense. My Claudian smell.
Ah, Morgan, Green, thank you for coming. Borada, handsome. Captain, what's this all about? Morgan, did you have to bring the ship's orchestra with you? They followed me in here, sir. Orchestra leader Alberto, would you pause a moment? Thank you. Do you have to rehearse in here?
I am sorry, sir, but we must practice at the ship's rehearsal room. She is currently occupied by the choir.
Very well. Carry on. But please, quietly.
Aye, aye, sir.
Now,
the Brahms.
Thank you. Now, Computer Ronnie, would you please scan Engineer Green's body and brainwaves and tell me if you detect any unusual readings?
Can't get into it. I'm on downtime. Do it yourself.
Please cooperate, Ronnie.
Very well. I'm scanning. No unusual readings detected, Captain. Chief Engineer Green is radiating perfectly.
What's this all about, Captain? Why have you asked yon pile of junk to scan my person?
We are a little worried about you, Green. Are you feeling yourself?
I am, sir.
You are not fatigued or discombobulated?
No, sir. I never felt better.
You...
Ow! That blasted cat scratched my hand.
So he did. And look what he has drawn out with his claws.
Alberto, did you have to do that?
I am sorry, sir. I can only follow the score as she is written.
Did you say this was Brahms?
Yes, Captain, Brahms, one of your great English composers.
I don't think Brahms was English.
This Brahms was English.
I see. Well, carry on, but quietly, please. I don't really approve of background music in space dramas. Now, for Flav, you were saying?
Look what Doggerel has drawn out with his claws.
A yellow wire. Green, roll up your sleeve and show us your hand and wrist. Your skin is like plastic. It just peels away, and here, beneath, Green, you're a robot.
Not at all, sir. Well, a wee bit. I have a robot hand. Ow! Now he's scratched my arm.
Revealing more wires and transistors, and that little blue thing, that's a Siemens capacitor. That can hold an awful lot of Siemens.
I have a robot forearm, too.
How long have you had a robot forearm, Green?
As long as I can remember, sir.
I do not believe you. Shall I allow Doggerel to scratch you somewhere else, Green? No, I thought not. You must admit that you are, in fact, entirely robotic. So I ask you, robot, what have you done with the real Chief Engineer, Green?
What's happening, Captain?
Something is appearing before us. Three somethings. Reggie and Ronnie, quickly, scan this apparition. What is it?
An alien substance campaign. Nonsense. It's three alien substances. In fact, three aliens of unknown substance.
My aunt, they are quite hideous.
Who are the hideous aliens and what do they want? What has happened to Chief Engineer Green? Will the orchestra ever be able to face the works of Brahms again? Join me, Captain Handsome, to find out next week in the next thrilling episode of The Venus Probe.
I was jolted from that delightful and nostalgic vision by the arrival of the train at Yellowing Station, a vast glass and metal construction more like an airport terminal than a railway station in the small town famous for having been occupied during the Civil War by the Weebles, who were, of course, of the royalist persuasion. They may have wobbled once or twice in their support of the crown, but they never fell down. I was joined in my compartment by a very picturesque young woman who took off her long coat and sat down opposite me with an engaging smile and a very tight sweater. I did not ogle her. I believe ogling young women, or indeed anyone, to be improper. I concluded some years ago that the only circumstance in which it is both safe and acceptable to undress a young person with one's eyes is when that young person is blind. Even then, the process has its risks, so that I try to adopt the saintly approach of only ogling the blind in complete darkness. I felt I could no longer enjoy my trumpets, so put it back into my bag and took out the latest number of the Bibliographical Society Journal, which had arrived only that morning, and began to leaf through its richly illustrated pages. Here was a paper by Cassio Stinkleton, whom I had been at school with, on the aberrant signature which appeared on page 261, nominally 2L3 recto, of the second Venetian edition of Pardon's Imbecilicon of 1593. It filled most of the journal, some 80 pages, and I made a mental note not to bother to read it, since it looked incredibly dull. This was followed by a series of brief notes. The first was on the bottom half of the woodcut device of the Strasbourg printer Pincus Nuts, which the author, Mercurius Monkspeller, a young Turk, claimed was actually the top half of the woodcut device of the Cologne printer, Nervus Trinkpepsi, inverted. A few years ago, Monkspeller had been my student at Timor Mortis, but had been so slow-witted that he'd never quite understood what he was doing in Knoxford, and was, despite his name, unable even to spell the word monk. The next note was by the great Michael Ribwright, current president of the Bibliographical Society, and concerned the curly red-brown hairs which had been enclosed by the great 18th-century beauty, Lady Charlotte Parsley Runt, in many of the letters she had sent to her admirers and lovers around the world. These hairs were much prized as deriving, the lady claimed, from her privy parts, and Ribwright had been involved in an attempt to publish a definitive edition of this amorous correspondence, with photographic reproductions of all the extant tufts and curls of hair. He had realised, however, that there was more hair even in the collection of the Bibli Boblion, which holds a significant number of Parsley Runt letters, than one woman's person could possibly have supplied, even if that woman's person had been a particularly lushly hairy one. The answer to this conundrum was found in a letter, published here in the Bibliographical Society Journal, from Lady Charlotte to her sister Ruth, in which she wrote, "I am discommoded by requests from ardent gentlemen, and indeed ladies, for my favours, and regret that I once began the habit of sending these suitors, as recompense for their disappointment, a little of my love carpet, so that I am now very nearly bald in that quarter, and have little left with which to please Lord Lamberton, who has my heart, and Sir Miles, who possesses the rest of me.
But I have found a means to satisfy all comers now. I saw, quite by chance, a beautiful red-haired terrier whose hair was of the same hue and vibrant curl as my own, and purchased her for but a guinea. She is a most affectionate bitch, if a little silly, and I have named her Ruth after you, my dear sister. Now, when I need a little token of dissuasion, I clip it from Ruth's thick and lustrous coat, and the more I dislike the suitor, the nearer to Ruth's fundament do I clip the hairs. It was a masterful short piece, as one would expect from Ribwright. I turned the page to the first book review and was horrified to read the name of the reviewer. It was Cornelius Bunce. 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 The sight and sound of that name set my bones awry and my teeth a-jangle. If my dear brother Starwheel is the Mycroft to my Sherlock, then Cornelius Bunce is the Professor Moriarty. He is my bibliographical nemesis. All bibliographers must, of course, have a nemesis, and Bunce is mine. The swine. We were once, some 50 years ago, rivals for the heart of the beautiful Minerva Columba, the sweet dove. I won that heart, albeit our bliss was short-lived. But like the story of the giant rat of Sumatra, the world is not yet ready for that true tale. Not, as in the case of the rat, for the unspeakable horror of the narrative, but for its unbearable sadness. Suffice it to say that once Bunce had lost the competition for that most perfect love to McQueen, he never forgave or gave quarter, and took every opportunity to foil, confound, obstruct, deceive, and shaft me, beginning with the review he published in 1976 in the very organ I was now holding of my first monograph, a bibliographical account of the works of Jackie Collins. It was, I can barely recall it without tears of fury, a most unfair review in which he called my work inaccurate, citing two small typographical errors only, and its subject unworthy of scholarly attention, an insult to the greatest author then living. This was only the beginning of a war twixt the two of us, in which he struck again and again with spears of unjust criticism at the heart of my being, which is, of course, my bibliographical work. On a few occasions when I have been asked to review works by Bunce, I have declined to do so on the grounds that I could not assess them dispassionately. But he has no such scruples, and yet I might have written critical assaults upon his work with the angels on my side, for he is a bogus bibliographer, a rogue and a charlatan who clings to the digressive principle like a mad clergyman clinging to the Assumption of the Virgin, and could not write an accurate or consistent collation formula if his life depended upon it. He believes and states that vellum and parchment are precisely the same material. He must one day be brought to justice. But as I began to read the review of a quite innocuous work of middling scholarship, which he laid into without mercy, I perceived that he was still very much at large and at it again, not this time attacking McQueen, but some other harmless toiler in the vineyard. These unhappy notions were joined by a still more prickly thought. I was on my way to the Duodecimo Club. Could Bunce be there when I arrived? I recall his insistence that the name of the club be pronounced Duodecimo, which I found profoundly infuriating, because he was, in essence, right about this issue, and I had, like most, accepted Duodecimo simply because of its currency among other members. The bastard! How I hate and despise Cornelius Bunce! But then a happy thought struck me. I had heard that Bunce had applied for, and won, one of the Bibliographical Society's grants for sending unpopular bibliographers to faraway places, so that he was likely to be many miles away, in Melbourne, nominally examining the collection of Aboriginal dung pellets in the University Library there. He was thus unlikely to be at the Duodecimo Club this evening, and upon that happy thought, I slipped into a deep and dreamful sleep. The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Today's chapter was sponsored by the Bibliographical Society of London and by Gruber's 67 Varieties, among which is the world's most delicious tomato ketchup. It was written and performed by Paul W. Nash, Bibliographer. Next time in The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer.
Welcome to the Confessions of Dr. Marvel.
These are my most secret secrets, my tales of the famous, the infamous and the fabulously wealthy, which I have sworn on all manner of gods and signed all manner of contracts never to reveal. I am in hiding now, and in truth, close to death. I saw him in the garden yesterday by the petunias. He seemed to be searching for something. When these confessions are published, my life will be worth less than the drips from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales's toothbrush. Although, in truth, the Royal Dentifactor sometimes sells these on eBay for a significant sum to supplement his meagre income. The hitmen hired by Her Majesty will be on my trail, as will the hired goons of Beckham, Murray, I mean Jenny, not Andy, Lloyd Webber, and 100 others. But they are unlikely to find me before I am claimed by the rare and fatal condition from which I am now suffering. For the past 30 years I have been the private magician to royalty, the nobility and the glitterati. I have entertained them in their palaces and mansions with magic performances tailored to their requirements, and I have performed such tricks, such magic, that no common man or woman has ever seen. The antics of Daniels or Mescaline are as nothing to my magnificent, breathtaking and impossible feats, all performed for money behind rich curtains and gilded doors for a privileged few. I have wasted my talents. I have grown rich, but now that I am facing my end, I would trade all my gold and diamonds for one night at the London Palladium and an audience of cabmen and cockney floozies. But I can no longer work magic, so I will reveal my secrets instead. And first, my tale of the highest in the land, our monarch herself. I have seen a side of Her Majesty, known only to her family and a few privileged servants. I have performed for her many feats, but her favourite trick, which she demanded I repeat on every occasion I appeared before her, was a very simple one. She commanded me to hypnotise a member of her family, whichever was in the deepest disgrace at the time, and convince them that they were a chicken. After a little clucking and running round the staterooms in terror, fleeing an illusory fox, I was instructed to demand of the chicken an egg. Well, you can imagine what happens if you convince Prince Andrew, say, or Camilla Parker Bowles, that they are a chicken and demand that they lay an egg. Ugh. I'm afraid Her Majesty always laughed uproariously at the outcome.
Fetch me the codex.